All right, good afternoon. We are here today for oral argument in the case of Schutte versus ProHealth and others. And I've just gone blank on the case number, 22-1087. And this is on a special expedited schedule under the provisions of the Class Action Fairness Act. And we'll first hear from Mr. Eckstein, counsel for plaintiff.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, there are two ways for this court to reverse the district court. There's an easy way and there's a slightly less easy way, but both ways are correct. The easiest way concerns the amount in controversy and how SIOCS did not meet its burden of proof of showing that the damages at issue here exceed $5 million. When SIOCS removed this matter from state court to federal court, it alleged the amount in controversy exceeded $5 million, and that was then challenged by Schutte. Once challenged, that triggered an obligation on SIOCS's part to offer evidence to substantiate that the amount in controversy here actually exceeds $5 million. In other words, we were beyond a pleading stage, and it was now the put up or shut up stage. Here, SIOCS attempted to meet its burden of proof solely with the affidavit of an employee named Mr. Malinak. And Mr. Malinak asserted that upon his review of corporate records, there were in excess of 700,000 requests from which came from Wisconsin residents to Wisconsin healthcare providers in which a fee was charged. There's other details in the affidavit, but let's focus on the first part right now. The number of in excess of 700,000 certainly sounds impressive at first glance, but there's a critical omission there. It lacks critical foundation, and that is the time period SIOCS was looking at to figure out the number of requests at issue here was from 2015 to 2021. And the problem with that is four of those 6 years, there were actually dual systems under which records could be priced. One was.
I understand that's your position, Mr. Eckstein, but there were 2 years in which Wisconsin law would have provided the governing standard for all such requests, including Ms. Schutte's, correct?
That is correct. So
unless there are wildly improbable differences from year to year in the numbers of requests, is it unreasonable to assume there are at least 200,000 requests that were governed by the Wisconsin statute?
It is, because there's no factual anchor at all for making that determination. From 2016 to 2020, until SIOCS was successful at having the Azar decision, there's no way to know proportionally how many requests were under one law as opposed to another.
The premise of my hypothesis is that all for the last 2 years would have been subject to the Wisconsin statute.
Correct. And there's no way to know over that given period of time how many requests were on average made during any given year. In other words, there's
no... Can I ask you, Mr. Eckstein, can you direct us to other cases where plaintiffs have successfully resisted federal jurisdiction by arguing that their own allegations about damages should not be taken seriously?
No, because the law...
You've got your own allegations say there are thousands of class members, and you're invoking a statute and the potential for exemplary damages for up to $25,000 per violation. You say that's not... You don't think that's realistic, but the question is a legal certainty, right, under our case law?
Yes. We have alleged that we're seeking to represent a class of several thousand individuals. We don't know how many that is. We just allege that to meet our burden of proof on numerosity. And it is true that we have also sought compensatory and punitive damages. But when you're talking about assessing the amount in controversy now, once it's challenged, that has to be bottomed on proof, on evidence.
It's and an under admission Wisconsin- by the plaintiff.
Excuse
you
me?
You want evidence, it's an admission by the plaintiff.
The only admission by the plaintiff here is that we seek to represent thousands of others that might have typical claims. And typical claims here, what we're talking about is claims that arise from the same type of transaction, the claims and defenses are typical. That's what's required of us under Rule 23. That speaks nothing to the damages that were sustained, though, and whether damages were typical. The jurisprudence in the Seventh Circuit is crystal clear that just because claims may be typical, that says nothing about damages.
And in fact, I understand your point that you don't want to be stuck with Ms. Schutte's $61 as an average. And I agree with you on that. Judge Adelman focused on your attempts to get exemplary damages. And it's hard for me to see where he went wrong with that.
Where he went wrong with that is punitive damages require as a factual predicate compensatory damages. And as this court's jurisprudence has said, punitive damages, where that forms the largest basis for an invocation of jurisdiction, that has to be closely scrutinized. Here, there is no compensatory damages beyond the single charge to Ms. Schutte that provides any kind of evidentiary basis for this court to closely scrutinize the punitive damages that are actually at issue. For example, this court's decision in LM reminded that when closely scrutinizing punitive damages, you still have to even take into consideration that, generally speaking, the Supreme Court has admonished that a single-digit multiplier for punitive damages sets the outlier for what is even permissible under due process.
But what about we're talking here about, in terms of due process, we're talking about damages that are expressly authorized by statute. So somebody who gets into this business is on fair notice that that's what they could be facing, right?
Fair notice, whether we allege it in our complaint or not.
Right. And then in our cases, particularly those involving relatively low amounts of compensatory damages under consumer protection theories, whether statutory or common law, we've allowed ratios a lot higher than that. The bed bug case comes to mind, Mathias. So.
Sure. Even the Supreme Court's precedent acknowledges that where compensatory damages are low, punitive damages in excess of a single-digit multiplier might be appropriate. But that statement right there is couched in terms of what the compensatory damages are. Here, the only information in the record as to what compensatory damages are at issue is the single invoice for Donna Schutte, which totals $61.23.
Okay.
Mr.
Rexton, could I turn you to, time is short here, I'd like to turn you to the local controversy exception under CAFA.
Sure.
And I want to make sure I understand your position correctly. Suppose there is a series of class actions filed in different states under different state laws, all against the same defendants, all under the same provision, let's say, of the UCC or another uniform law.
Sure.
All are challenging the same business practice as a violation of the different respective state statutes. In your view, does that take the cases outside of the local controversy exception, or is that prohibited?
I understand the question. That hypothetical certainly challenges the limits of our argument, because there, without knowing what conduct is at issue and whether the defendant specifically
assume that the different complaints are Xeroxes of each other, essentially, except for the location and the specific state statute.
Sure. So I'll assume then that the defendant is not entering into those states to engage in business with a specific mind's eye to following that state's individual laws. So we're talking about a defendant that engages in nationwide conduct, and that conduct just happens to violate uniform laws in several states. That's what I understand the court's question to be.
Correct.
My reading of the local controversy exception is that it requires three things for it to be successfully invoked. Number one is a pleading requirement. Was there another class action filed? And a class action, by definition, is representative in nature. Number two is a defendant-focused inquiry, and that is, does that class action allege the same or similar factual allegations against any defendant? And under your hypothetical, Your Honor, it sounds like the same or similar factual allegations might be able to be made there. But the third element is a plaintiff-centered element. And that is that that class action against the defendant seeking similar, the same or similar factual allegations is brought on behalf of the same or other persons. Mm-hmm. In that situation, that plaintiff-centered element would preclude one class action filed in, say, Montana under Montana's UCC, seeking only damages for Montana citizens, from implicating or defeating the local controversy exception for a Wisconsin-only class action.
So you would say, to my hypothetical, you'd say, no, state belongs in state court.
Yes, and here's why.
Because the classes are in different states.
No, because they are brought on behalf of different people. What I'm saying is the local controversy exception has three separate elements.
Okay, just because you derive this notion from the phrase on behalf of the same or other persons, and you think that means something other than anybody else.
Correct, because class action by definition is brought on behalf of someone else, and that's the first requirement. There has to be another class action filed in the preceding 3 years. That by definition is going to be brought on behalf of someone. It's the second and the third elements that require closer scrutiny. The factual allegations that you're looking for, at least in the context of UCC, you do not have to show the violation of a particular regulation. It's just the UCC.
Now, what makes this... You're moving away from the question about about who the members of the prospective classes are. That's
correct.
What I'd like you to focus on, because you seem to take an extraordinary reading of this statutory phrase, the same or other persons.
We think we're taking a plain reading of it, and we're not moving away from it. What we're saying it is, it's one part of a three-part test. The same, brought on behalf of, that plain language assumes a representative capacity. On behalf of who would have to be the same or other persons. But the same or other persons is a phrase that goes together. We're not just looking at whether there's another class action, because again, that's the first element. The first element is a pleading requirement where we're looking at whether another class action filed on behalf of someone was filed in the preceding 3 years.
But isn't your adversary going to say there are other persons? They're Montana. They're Montana residents or citizens in Deming. In your case, they're Wisconsin.
And that's my point. The plaintiff-centered inquiry looks for some kind of overlap between one class action and another.
Where do you get that? I mean, you keep saying that, but where in the world do you get that from? You can't get it through the sheer force of assertion.
No, I get it from the plain language of on behalf of the same or other persons.
Do you have any case, federal case, where the federal court concluded that two class actions are not similar because the plaintiffs were not similar?
Sure. We've cited the Anderson versus Hackett decision. We've also cited the Raspberry decision. Now, in both of those cases, I'm sorry, go ahead, Your Honor.
No, Anderson had other differences.
Right, and there are other differences here as well. I was responding to the judge's hypothetical that the alleged violation was the violation of a uniform law under UCC. Our point is that the third element, the plaintiff-centered element, it has to require some type of factual overlap between the two, because if all we're looking at is whether a class action was filed asserting the same or similar factual allegations, there would be no reason for Congress to further require an additional element as to whether that class action was brought on behalf of the same or other people. The class action, the first element, already assumes that there is a class filed on behalf of other people. So why would Congress say you're going to look for a class action filed on behalf of other people in the first element and then ask, well, was that class action filed on behalf of the same or other people?
Well, this whole elements construct is of your own making. I mean, you're the one that's come up with the three elements, not Congress. Congress
came
up.
Reading,
go ahead.
It's based on my reading of the statute, specifically how the court is to look at whether, one, a class action, which is specifically defined by Congress as an action filed under Rule 23 or any state analog that seeks representative capacity. Two, asserts the same or similar factual allegations against any defendant. And three, brought on behalf of the same or other people. It doesn't make sense to me why Congress would ask, is there a class action brought on behalf of other people?
Excuse me, Mr. Eckstein, but this seems to be, if I'm remembering correctly, this seems to be kind of anti-redundancy canon on steroids. And that canon of statutory interpretation or contract interpretation for that matter is one that has really some of the weakest empirical foundations. And we've repeatedly noted that there are plenty of times when some redundancy will be put into a legal document for emphasis.
I can't speak to the empiricalness of it. All I can say is what I'm trying to do is give meaning to the words that Congress put on the page.
Okay.
And when Congress, and Your Honor, I'm almost out of time, but I requested 3 minutes to reserve in rebuttal. I see I've blown through that, however, but if anybody has any additional questions,
I'm happy to answer. I have one quick question that I'd like to ask before we get into Mr. Lefkowitz's response, and you'll have an opportunity to provide rebuttal. But is it correct that plaintiff's view is that any fee for electronic records, electronic health records, would violate the Wisconsin statute?
No.
Okay. Which ones would not?
Wisconsin 14683 lists the fees that would be appropriate. Those are all appropriate fees, and there is no fee there that's listed for electronic per page copy. So our allegation here is that you can charge whatever fees are permissible by statute, but here you charge paper copy rates for electronic copies of records. That's where they went wrong.
Okay. Could they charge any fee for retrieving, organizing, and producing to you electronic records?
Yes, if that was made without authorization of the patient in writing. And that's the Moya decision.
Wait a minute.
The mere fact
permissible? Such fees are permissible?
There are circumstances where healthcare providers can charge retrieval and certification fees even if the record is electronic. There's no limitation on what fees can be charged based on the format of the records. What can be charged is the specific fees that are listed in the statute. And so it just so happens that here they charge us a fee that does not apply because it's not in the statute.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, and we'll give you some time for rebuttal. Mr. Lefkowitz for the defendants.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity to argue today, Your Honors, and I'll try to be brief. And I want to just pick up on where you left off because it actually ties into the very first thing Your Honor said about the two-year window. In fact, if you look at their class allegations, and as this court said in the Back Doctors case, that is the only basis that we look at removal petitions. We don't look at post hoc arguments in briefing. They allege at page 15 that their class is anybody who was charged by PsyOps any kind of electronic fee, either a paper fee for electronic copies, an electronic archive data fee, or any other similar impermissible fees. And they repeat again at paragraph 25 of the complaint that their allegation is that any of those fees violate Wisconsin law. That's it. So therefore, there is actually no reason at all to even look only at the two-year window. It is certainly true that there was a period of time where PsyOps believed that there was some safe harbor under federal law, and it believed that Wisconsin law didn't bear on electronic records at all. It turned out we were wrong. The Wisconsin Court of Appeals has said no charges for electronic records. But the way federal preemption works under HIPAA, and this is at section 264C2 of HIPAA and at 45 CFR 160.203B of the implementing regulations, a company like PsyOps is required to always abide by the more restrictive rule, the one-way preemption. And so to the extent that Wisconsin law since 2011 has said you may not charge for any electronic records, all 700,000 times that we charged for electronic record requests violates Wisconsin law, and that's their claim. They are not in any way limiting their claim to just the last 2 years. They're not giving a safe harbor for people who were charged $650, and there is nothing in Wisconsin law that provides such a safe harbor. So I believe that we have clearly established by this court standard, which is to plausibly and adequately give a good faith estimate, that's the Rappo case, And with respect to punitive damages, in the back doctor's case, that this court looked at a complaint that didn't even ask for punitive damages and said, yeah, but punitive damages are permissible. Therefore, they are not, as this court in Spivey said, legally impossible. Here, we have much more than that. We actually have an assertion of willful misconduct. And again, leaving aside the question that I think you may have been hinting at, which is there a constitutional due process difference between traditional punitive damages and statutory exemplary damages, which is something that is still a bit of an uncertain issue in the appellate courts, we don't need close to 25,000 for each one. If you just assumed for each of the 700,000, just the $2 automatic electronic fee, plus a couple dollars of potential exemplary damages, and then you assumed instead of a 64-page record that Ms. Schutte had, maybe only 4 or 5 pages of a typical record, you're well over the amount in controversy. And this court has made clear that we apply the same liberal standards to removal allegations as we do to all other pleading under the federal rule. So I believe that there's no question that the Judge Adelman got it right when he looked at both the compensatory and the punitive damages. To be sure, they are not disclaiming either in their complaint. If they want to disclaim compensatory damages, that would be a very different story. We could move on, but they haven't done that. And therefore, the exemplary damages are certainly not legally impermissible here.
I'd like Mr. Lefkowitz, I'm sorry, go ahead and finish your thought.
Oh, I was going to move on to local exception with the remaining few minutes.
Okay, go ahead. I got a question for you there, but go ahead and get started.
So, again, the statute is very clear. During the 3-year period preceding the filing of that class action, no other class action has been filed asserting the same or similar factual allegations against any of the defendants on behalf of the same or other person. I'll take the second part first, because I think that's just the easiest. It's absolutely clear. This is a situation where Congress was using language to be absolutely clear that if it was a class action filed by anyone, it didn't have to be the same class. Well, and in Deming, we clearly had a different class. With respect to the other prior Wisconsin cases that we referred to, they are actually overlapping classes. But Deming is what Judge Adelman reflected on, and Deming is clearly similar. In fact, it is almost identical factually. Neither Montana nor Wisconsin had an express statute that addressed electronic records. We took the position that, therefore, we could charge what we wanted for electronic records. It turned out in Deming, we were right, and just about an hour ago, the Ninth Circuit affirmed the lower court decision in Deming. In Wisconsin, it turned out we were wrong. The Banuelos court said, sorry, even though there's no language with electronic record fee schedule, that means you can't charge anything. But the facts are the same. The facts that they are alleging are that we are charging fees for electronic records that we're not allowed to charge.
Mr. Lefkowitz, let me ask you, I'm sorry, can you hear me okay? We're getting a little static.
Absolutely.
In the courtroom.
I can hear you perfectly.
Okay. So if we were to try to look just a touch beyond the plain meaning of the applicable statutory language and say, what is Congress really driving at here? Because Mr. Eckstein makes some pretty good points that, look, this sure seems local. It's about as local can be. And I benefit from your response to the point that's made in the Senate Judiciary Committee's report that one of the considerations here, or a primary one perhaps around the language in question, is looking at whether the respective actions are amenable to consolidation for pretrial coordination purposes under the MDL statute. So in your view, if you had Wisconsin and Deming and Smith and Doe and Watson, and you just sprinkle them around the United States, given the allegations and just assume they're like the ones we have here, would they be amenable to pretrial coordination under the MDL statute?
I think they might be in the following respect. I think that if the plaintiff had brought a nationwide class action in state court alleging violation nationwide of Ciox's electronic billing practices in all 50 states, and post-CAFA, clearly pre-CAFA, you couldn't remove it. But post-CAFA, if you had 5 million in controversy, 100 members of the class, and even minimal diversity, you would be able to remove it. And you would treat it all in one federal nationwide class. I think it would turn CAFA on its head to say that you could essentially file 50 independent state court class actions, each alleging violations of electronic billing practices, but simply with respect to different states. And I think what Congress is getting at here is very clear. They say at page 16 of their brief, and I think this is really where they kind of double down. They say every class action can be, quote, localized by asserting a cause of action under a specific state's regulation on behalf of a geographically diverse or defined class. But clearly, if one purpose of CAFA is that we're similar conduct is occurring in multiple jurisdictions, then that conduct is rightfully heard in federal court. It doesn't matter whether the conduct challenged is in a single action or multiple actions. And I do think, as Judge Jackson Akinwumi pointed out, the Anderson case is very different. There were actually very different facts in that case. One, the facts were failing to give warning. The other was facts related to how the company handled the hazardous waste. And in addition, that was a case where the court suggested, at least in dicta, maybe because it was dealing with toxic ports in real property, in one particular locale, that might have some impact on the local controversy aspect. Even that, I think, is questionable. The Sixth Circuit in the case involving the water issues in Flint, Michigan, said, sorry, as long as there have been other cases with similar facts, even the local-centric aspect of Flint, Michigan's water problem do not make it a local exception. But I don't think we have to deal with that here at all, because I think the other Wisconsin cases and certainly the Montana case are on all fours here. It is not, I mean, I would say Deming is identical, other than the law, but certainly it rises to the level of similar facts. And I think that's all that's required.
Mr. Lefkowitz, one of the things that I've kind of had to stay focused on in thinking about this case is the difference between certifying a particular class in one class action versus the MDL possibility with multiple state class actions. Under our court's jurisprudence, as I understand it, it would be quite difficult to certify a nationwide class, even under 50 different states, identical state statutes. We've made that very difficult. The Bridgestone-Firestone MDL case comes to mind, along with an MDL that I presided over as a district judge, where we split things up into state-by-state class actions. And use the MDL process. The first state class action would have to stay in state court, right?
The very first class action brought would probably stay in state court unless there was other yeah. Perfect diversity or something like that.
Which is at least a little odd. Well, let me ask you, if we were to agree with your reading as to the meaning of on behalf of the same or other persons, and we focus on the element of the same or similar factual allegations, how would you suggest we articulate the rule? How should we write an opinion that guides district courts?
I would commend this court to the 10th Circuit's decision in Dutcher, not to suggest that this court should in any way be bound by what a sister circuit suggests. But I think they address this very clearly, and they say differences in the cause of action pleaded are not enough to distinguish cases under the demands of
Catholic. Right. Okay. In terms of legal theories, I understand that. And we say time and again, you don't even have to put a legal theory into your complaint.
Right.
But let's think about this context of your client's business. Suppose we had another class action in another state arguing that you had were systematically overcharging for paper healthcare records.
So I think that's a fair question. And look, all cases call for some degree of kind of trying to find the right line. And then as you get closer to the line, things get a little blurry. I'll give you an answer. I'm privileged to do a lot of defense work for PSYOPs. We have cases all around the country that make different types of allegations. We've been sued in cases where you're alleged, for example, to have misled the other side. You charge them for 100 pages, but you only provide 10. That's a very different factual basis, even though it's an overcharging case. We've had cases where we're alleged to have provided documents to someone who didn't have the appropriate HIPAA certification, and so that might raise privacy concerns. I wouldn't necessarily say that those are similar factually, but I'm hard-pressed to find how you could be any more similar without being identical, of course, is also covered by the word same, than two cases both alleging that you charged for electronic records when the statute didn't give you the authorization, as you pointed out, Your Honor, to charge for any electronic records. I think by any definition, by any yardstick, those are similar cases.
Mr. Lefkowitz, I follow you there. If I could just take you back to the amount of controversy, does your argument depend on this, what I construe as a broader reading of plaintiffs, the language in plaintiff's complaint that the district court did, where Ms. Schutte is talking about electronic fees, electronic data fees, and other impermissible fees? I think one fair reading of other impermissible fees is that they're relating to electronic fees, fees related to electronic medical records. I think your position is other impermissible fees means all kinds of other impermissible fees. And that leads you to part of your argument about your $727,000. Does your argument really need to depend on that?
I don't think so. And I also point out that at at paragraph 25 of their complaint, where they define the violation of Wisconsin law, they say including paper fees for electronic copies of paper health records, comma, electronic data archive fees, comma, and other fees. But I would submit, Your Honor, that because Wisconsin law has made clear that with respect to an electronic record request, no fee is permissible, that it actually doesn't matter how broadly or narrowly you read that those two paragraphs in the complaint. What the affidavit or the declaration makes clear is that we fulfilled 720 some odd thousand requests for electronic copies of medical records in which a fee was charged or where there was an electronic delivery and an archive fee. Every single one of those requests that had any of those types of fees falls squarely within what they claim violates Wisconsin law.
If I could just ask one quick question more. What is the status of your effort to get review from the Wisconsin Supreme Court on that question of state law?
We have petitioned the court. We're waiting. I believe, don't quote me, but I believe that it's a discretionary court. I don't know if they'll even take the case. I hope they do.
But your request is still pending.
Yes, but again, okay. For purposes of removal, I don't think the merits ultimately matter.
Yeah. Any further questions for Mr. Lefkowitz? All right. Mr. Eckstein, please go ahead, up to 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. If we start where we left off there with Mr. Lefkowitz, even if the allegations concern absolutely every single fee allowed under the sun or impermissible under the sun, there is still no factual anchor in this record as to what that amount amounts to, either as an aggregate number for damages or as an actual average number for a typical class member. The only number on damages that's in the record before the court is $61.23. That's it. And when Mr. Lefkowitz was arguing about punitive damages, saying, but Wisconsin law allows up to $25,000 for punitive damages, that's true as a theoretical matter. But when we're assessing whether they've met their burden, which is beyond the allegation stage after they've removed, once challenged, they have a burden of producing evidence, the question becomes, what amount is really a controversy here? A predicate for punitive damages under Wisconsin law is compensatory damages. I cannot get up in front of a jury and ask a jury only for punitive damages. There must be compensatory damages allowed before punitive damages can stick. And that's our point. Without any meaningful information on what compensatory damages are actually in controversy between the parties, punitive damages are a legal impossibility at that stage. And again,
it sounds like on that point, what you'd be arguing is that we ought to send it back for jurisdictional discovery, in essence.
Well, what I would say is no, because no party has asked for that. And Sciox is here saying that their presentation clearly passes this court's precedent. What I'm asking for is a determination that it does not, that they have their chance to offer evidence, just like plaintiffs have their chance to meet the local controversy exception, for example, with evidence. And if that's not met with evidence, then the court's judgment stands. Here, we're asking for reversal and a direction that this case be remanded back to state court. As for what the rule of law should be with respect to the local controversy exception, if the court's going to be guided by the Dutcher decision, one thing that I think the court has to keep in mind is that when looking at defining what similar factual allegations are, setting aside the on behalf of the same or other people, what Dutcher was really getting at is that you cannot use legal theories alone as a way of pleading around another class action. And when you look at the facts here, Your Honor, the critical factual ingredients at issue are that Wisconsin imposes a statutory duty under 146.83 that can be separately sought, you can seek redress for, under a separate statutory mechanism of 146.84. This class action is about Wisconsin citizens under a Wisconsin statutory duty stemming from requests made of Wisconsin healthcare providers. None of that is legal theory. All of that are factual allegations.
Okay. All right, our thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement, and we are conscious of the deadlines for our decision under the statute. So with that, the court will be in recess.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much, Your Honors.